Welcome to the Dope Black Woman podcast, the podcast where we share stories of Black excellence as part of our safe digital sisterhood.
Hey guys, it's Fashan, and as we're officially in Black History Month, we thought we would do something a little different on this month's podcast. Here on Dope Black Women, we're all about elevating Black women and sharing their stories. So this month, myself, Leanne and Livs will be sharing the podcast with some people that we admire for them to tell their stories too. I wanted to bring on some guests that are really close to me to talk about belonging, determination and overcoming obstacles. I thought, who better to have this conversation with than my very own family? So to share their experience of Black Britain, I'm joined by, first and foremost, my nan, who's with me on the podcast.
Hi, girl.
Who's, for context, is in her 60s. You've heard me talk about her before on the podcast before as well, but since this older is here, I'm not going to explain why. Something I admire a lot about my nan is her drive to always perfect her craft. And even now she's retired, she's still exploring and testing things out. And I think that definitely rubs off on me too. And then to my left, I have my great gran, who I just call gran, who's on the podcast, who's in her 80s.
Wagwan.
What I love about my gran in particular is that she's got a really big heart. She's really intuitive and she's one of the most caring people I know. She sets a real precedent for what it means to be a dope Black woman or a dope Black mum. So on today's podcast, I'm going to be exploring Black Britain through the eyes of my nan and gran. So gran, how did you get here? I'm joking. No, but seriously, I was talking to nan earlier today about whether or not you came in the Windrush, if you're a part of that generation, and I was a bit confused with whether that applies to you or not. So how did you come to England?
I came here in 1957. I came on a boat that they call Aeropina boat.
Mm.
Yes. There's a lot of people came on it, a lot of passengers.
And what was it that made you want to come to England?
Well, I came here to do designing and dressmaking.
And was there stuff going on in Jamaica that forced you to come here? Or was it like you just wanted to come over?
No, I was doing dressmaking the year before, and I want to explore my experience more. So that's why I came here.
And what expectations did you have of England before you came?
Well, I thought it was a nice place and, you know, it was exciting. But when I came, it was different.
What made you think it was nice though, ma'am? What did you hear about it?
Well, it's a new it's a different country. And the point about it is this, that you've been in your country of birth and you want to explore, you want to know, you want to get to know somewhere that is different, because I never traveled before. So I thought here was the best place. Coming to England was good.
Did a lot of people talk about it to you, how exciting it was? I mean, did you hear those stories about streets paved with gold and all that?
No.
Because a lot of people used to believe that, literally.
No, I mean, this is it's a place where you could get jobs, you can, you know, you gain new experience, you know, you can expand more in your experience or your educational wise and things like that.
Okay.
Because Jamaica was a part of the Commonwealth at that time.
Mm.
So it was, you know, easy to get here and things like that.
And for those listening, what is the Commonwealth? For someone listening who doesn't understand what that means, what is the Commonwealth?
But the Queen was the head, was the leader, leading force in Jamaica.
So you was in Jamaica, you came over here at what age?
22.
And you thought it was going to be a really exciting experience for you to do your designing.
Yes.
Did England live up to its expectations?
No, because when we came here, when I came here, I suffered a lot of racism, you know? And it is something that one have to cope with. I just wanted us to go back to Jamaica, you know, but in the end, you try to fight it out the best way you possible can. But it wasn't pleasant as Black people.
Do you remember your first experience of racism?
My first experience is getting on the bus. And when you get on the bus, you sit beside people, they pull themselves up from you. They don't want to sit beside you because being Black, you know. And they'll tell you to go back where you come from.
Wow.
And I said, I'm not going back where I come from because I come for what you have taken away from our country.
You know what's crazy is that I still experience stuff like that now.
Yeah.
So you'd think that that was the 1950s and it's now like 70, 80 years onwards.
Yes.
But I still have that now. Like I was talking to my friend last week about, not even now during COVID, before the corona and all of that, I'd get on the train and sit next to someone and they would get up and move away and sit next to somebody else. So if they were if they moved away to an empty seat where nobody was on either side of them, I would assume they want their own space.
Yeah.
But for you to go and sit next to a white person,
it's
definitely because of my blackness. Do you get what I mean?
Yes, it was.
So it's quite sad actually that
it still happens.
Yeah, not a lot's changed.
Yes, it was really terrible in the 50s. When I came here, where a black person is concerned, because for instance, if you are working at the same place where somebody's working and you buy a car, you can sure the next Monday morning, if you go and they know that you have a car, you'll get the sack, because they are saying if you are working the same wages like what they're working, how can you afford to buy a car? So you find most people in those days, if they have a car, and they drive it to work, they have to hide it into a back street.
Wow.
Really?
Yes. Because you're working the same wages as me, you know, and how can you manage to buy a car?
I don't get that, though.
Yeah, but
what's
the
deal with management?
The thing about it is, you are working the same wage, and they're wondering how you can able to buy a car. It simply means that they will go to the pub, they smoke, they drink, and do whatever. And you, as a person, you don't drink or anything like that. So, because of that, you able to have more, you're able to can put away something.
Is that,
you know?
Is that something that was, is that something that applied to you because you're Christians, you don't really drink? Or is that widely across the black people?
A lot of people never drink because you see what happens.
You have pubs in Jamaica.
You find
the
culture here.
Yeah.
A lot of people smoke,
and
a lot of people drink.
But they smoke and drink in Jamaica.
Coming from the West Indies, a lot of people never smoke and drink, you know. It's, when they came here, they adopt the principle.
Really?
Yes, they adopt the culture.
True.
Because in our country, you understand what I mean? Maybe this generation here now does it.
Mm.
But you're hard to find people smoke a lot.
Quite interesting.
You know?
They didn't have pubs in Jamaica either, did they?
They call it bar.
That's right.
Yes, they will have bar, but I mean a few people. And now you find that those things are more now in Jamaica. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
But when I was growing up, you never have a lot of fun. People drink and all those sort of things. And a lot of people, black people, come in this country, they adopt the culture here to smoke. And they go to pub and all of those things.
But, Mum, based on what you just said, do you think that one of the reasons why a lot of people in Jamaica didn't drink or smoke was to do with their Christian upbringing? Because would you say that Jamaica is a much more of a God-fearing country than when you came over here and experienced the pubs and whatever?
Yes, in a sense, it's a God-fearing country. And you have a lot of people that wasn't Christian. And because it was a God-fearing country, but they don't drink. Because for instance, when it comes to coffee, my parents grow coffee and they sell coffee, but they didn't allow us to drink coffee.
Why not?
Because they said coffee is a drug, it's not good for you.
Right.
Really?
And yes, and they would never give us coffee to drink.
Do you drink it now?
No.
No, she doesn't.
We would go, they cultivate it, and we would even go to the field sometime and help them pick the coffee.
Mm.
You know, beans, coffee beans. But we never wasn't given coffee because it said it affects your brain.
So, Nan, we both gave our... Well, Granny gave her first experience of racism and I spoke about how it relates to what I still experience till this day. But what was your experience of racism like growing up?
It's hard to say because there's so many different variations of it. Some of it was kind of like... inadvertent, you didn't realize it was happening. And I think my first experience of racism that I can actually remember and understand as racism was when I was in secondary school, and I think a lot of people resonate with this, black people, where I was told even though I had the skills and the ability, that my job, this is what the career officer told me, I'm going to be working in Woolworths.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah? That's what I was told.
Yes, yes.
And if I was a stupid person and believed what she said, that's where I probably would be working.
But that's why they tell all black people.
But it sounds like it must have been a mantra at the time, because there's a lot of black people I've spoken to since then have said the same thing. Oh, God, that's what I was told.
Well, yes. Actually, Woolworths in particular as well.
Well, yes. I think they said it was Woolworths. But I something like retail. Or something like retail. So you go to the careers office for them to help you to decide what you're going to do with your future if you wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And all the black kids were told Woolworths.
Yes, yeah.
And I've got to realise as I, you know, got older that it was, I wasn't the only one, that a lot of other black kids were told that.
That
was my first experience of racism, and it was institutionalized as far as I'm concerned, in that
they tell a lot of black children that
you
was
didn't realize that that was,
but when you think about that now and look at society now, yeah. I think it makes a lot of sense into how like wealth is spread, because if you think about it, there's a lot of people I know who like, I want to be an actor, or I want to be this, I want to be that. And their parents would be like, you can't be that, or you can't be this. Yeah. And I look, because my mum's so different to that approach, I would look at that and be like, why's your mum being like that? Or why's your parents being like that?
Yeah.
But actually, if they grew up in an environment where the white teachers or whoever kept being demeaning towards them and making them feel like they couldn't do it, it's like ingrained in them that black people can't do these roles.
Yes, exactly.
It was successfully at least. But Granny, so you came over here at 22.
Mm-hmm.
Who did you come here with?
I came over with my sister.
Just one sister?
My sister and her husband. She was married.
So what was the reason why they were coming over?
Well, you know, finding the difficulty in Jamaica, you're weird job-wise and concerned. First, my father came over first.
Mm.
And my father only spent a year and 6 months here because he never liked it here. He never liked how men treat women. And he never liked that, you know, some of the men, they leave their wife in Jamaica and they come over here and they have other relationship and things like that. And he never liked it. And so he sent for my sister. Mm. And then after my sister came, our husband came.
Mm.
And even when I was to come over here, it was a difficult decision for my father to make.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said he don't like, you know, how people come here and live, and he don't like how men treat women. And eventually my sister was here and received me here.
So when you came here, you said that you wanted to come over to do like designing.
Yes.
That line of work.
Yes.
So when you first came, was that your first job? What was the type of work you were doing when you first came over?
Yes, my first job was to work with designers, Bordewell gowns in the West Indies, in the West End. I chiefly work in the West End with people that does designing and things like that.
Mm.
But it's sad to say I never have the privilege to achieve what I want to achieve, because I got married at 23.
And designed
within a year?
Yes.
You're Farsi? No way. Gran came over here to start a life, build a career.
Yes.
And she came here and got married within a year.
Yes, 23. Yeah. And then I started having children. And I could not able to, you know, achieve my desire that I wanted was to do my...
But you did kind of...
You know? But yet still I'm able to do a lot.
Something that relates to it, though.
Something related, because I work with a lot of designers, Laura Ashley, and all those different type of people that I work with.
Yeah, because I'm surprised to hear you say that, because my mum always talks, both my mum and Nan, but my mum in particular, because she tells me stories about you making her suits and stuff like that.
Yes.
So I feel like you still was able to express that passion. But life has changed, isn't it? And I guess that happens for everyone.
Like, say that you don't want to do that and go to London School of Fashion and all those things and have a certificate and things like that. Although I never do that. But I had a wide experience because I work with a lot of designers.
Yeah.
And they all want me back. So I spent many years in clothing trade, I mean to say, working for designers and things like that. And then after I started having my children, I still work from home.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Did you have your own business?
No. Work for designers and different... clothing trade from home.
I was saying a minute ago that you made mum's dresses. But you've actually made things for me as well. Because I remember when I had my prom outfit,
I came to you with my
designs, and we went to Tooting and got all the materials, and you made it exactly how I wanted it. And even the other day when I was going to the costume party, and I asked you to fix my my outfit for me.
But like, well, I saw for a lot of people privately. I do a lot of weddings. For the years, I will turn out four brides for the year.
But what was your biggest culture shock coming here?
The biggest shock, it's I love a family. I love to have a family, and I love my children very much. And the biggest shock is to know that, I mean, I have a broken marriage. You know, and my dream was shattered because I remember once we away from having the family home, we deposited a home. It has a shop.
The what home?
It has a shop. We were going to buy a other place, and this place has got a shop, and in enough rooms and whatever it is, and all my intention was to have a shop, you know, that I make my own things clothes. And clothes and all those sort of things. And we reach as far as to sign the contract, and then the person withdrew.
I didn't know this story, Mom.
Yeah, and the person withdrew, and then I never able to do that. But all my intention was to have a business, to work for myself, because I mean, to say I have the skills to do it, you know.
But in a way, Mom, even though you didn't get to do that, you did kind of live that dream, because I remember growing up, we were never short of anything, because you were always working in terms of the amount of people that came to them commission them to make clothes. I even remember growing up, right, Roshan? And my friends being jealous of me, because I could look in a magazine and say, Mom, can you make this for me? And she'd just rustle it up, and I'd have the latest outfit. Every time we had to go somewhere special, Mom, can you make this for me?
Always new, always new clothes.
But look how joke that is, that I do that to you now.
Yes, you do.
Do you know, every time it's carnival, I play T-shirt mass, which basically, do you know what that is? So it's like, when it's carnival, all the floats go down. And then people dress up in their, like, bikini outfits. Don't worry, I don't do that one. But there's one where you wear, like, a T-shirt. So everyone has the same top, and then you customise it. So I always go to Nan every single year of outfit. And she customises it for me, and she makes it into, like, patterns on my shorts and stuff. So it's interesting how it's all trickled down. But, you know, it's when I think about being black in Britain or in the UK, a lot of my blackness is expressed when I'm with my black friends. Or when I'm with, like, people that either are like me in race or are like me in class. And I feel like without that community of black people, would be, England would be a really hard place to navigate. Even in terms of thinking about microaggressions and institutionalized racism, like what Nam was talking about. Having a person that's black to outlet that with. Has a lot of good benefits for your mental health. Do you get what I mean? So when you came over here, it wasn't how Britain is now in terms of how diverse it is. So what was it like with connecting with other black people?
It make you feel like you belong, because I mean, you said in the 50s and the 60s, if you are going to live somewhere, you make sure that, you know, somebody black is around you. You understand what I mean? Because what was happening, if this street here is pure white people living on this road, and you came on the house, you came next door, and you buy a house next door to them, they sell their house.
Because
they says that you're bringing down the price street. The
price, oh my gosh!
Black,
that
happened. Black people.
That's nuts.
Yes, black people have suffered a lot of racism here, and the point about it is this: I believe the people in Britain, the English, should respect black people coming here because we do a lot
of the work that they did.
We build up this country and do a lot. When I came here, when their milkman come and buy bread, they put it on the step. And they never used to wrap them.
Protect it.
They'll put the open bread on the step. And who ate it? You?
No.
Eat it.
They take it up. Then the fish and chip shop, they were wrapping fish and chips in newspaper. You understand?
But I'm so confused.
That's how fish and chips used to be presented. Even when I was growing up, I remember that.
And the houses,
fish and chips was wrapped in newspaper.
What, because you're black or for everyone?
No, for everyone.
Oh.
And the houses, when you buy a house, you have to put your part in. I mean, it says, black, I mean, white people, English people should respect black people coming to this country because they never used to have baths in the house. They have those
big baths.
They have these big pans, you know, them.
The silver
yeah.
pans.
Yes, the big silver pans. That's what they used to have. They never used to have bath in their house. So you find that when a black person buy the house, they have to put baths in there. And the wash basin and all those sort of things.
But in the in the Caribbean, is baths and showers a thing? Because I know, like...
Yes, the people...
Or was it more like, what's it called? Bucket baths?
Yeah, people who don't have those facilities, they have the river where they go to swim and wash and have the bath and things like that. We're accustomed to wash. We're accustomed to water. Mm. You understand me? But when you buy a house... used to buy a house here in the 50s and the 60s,
mm-hmm.
you have to put bath in there. You have to
put showers. Get what you're saying. Because of their cleanliness, you're putting it in.
Yes.
Nuts.
Their hygiene was very different.
Their hygiene was
if you look at COVID now, and they're saying, wash your hand for 20 seconds. Excuse me. we didn't need to know that.
And when you came here, you couldn't get good clothes and all those things to buy in the shops. You understand me?
Yeah.
No.
Black people has done a world of good to this country.
Mm.
The hospitals, the everything.
Mm.
You understand me? And in the 50s and the 60s coming up, black kids has to work very hard to achieve. Because, for instance, when Paulette was going to school and they had science class, mm-hmm. right? And... she was in the hall was in the science class. So what they did that day, I don't know, some experiment they did. And Paulette can laugh. And Paulette laughed. And because she laughed, she was sent out of the class.
Mm.
So I get ready and I went over to school. And when I went over there, I said to the teacher, I understand you send over my daughter what she has done. Because we have Santa Claus and she laughed in the class. I said, was she alone the only one that laughed in the class? She said, no. So I said, why didn't you send home the others? Because she laughed the loudest. You understand me? And I remember I give her a little bit of it today. And after, you know, I just cried to see the injustice. And she says to me, do you want somebody to walk you home? I said, no, I am fine. You understand what I mean?
Mm.
And... these are the things that happen to our children, you understand? Our children in those days.
Because other kids were white, I'm assuming.
Yes, they suffer a lot of racism in school, you understand what I mean? And whatever they achieve, they have to work very hard for it.
Yeah.
I remember one of the teachers tell Joseph he wants to do, what they never call it, GCSE in that time.
CSE.
Yes, whole levels, the highest
all one. Levels. Yeah.
And it was in French, and she said, no, he's not going to do it. He can't do it in French. He's going to do it. He cannot do that exam in French. He must do the lower grade. You understand me? And he says, mommy, speak to them, because if I cannot do it in the higher grade, I'm not going to do it. You understand what I mean?
Mm. And what happened?
And so, yes, he get to do it in the higher grade. And when he pass and get the top mark in it, she couldn't look in his face.
Mm-hmm. Imagine. Do you know, Mum, it's funny because a very similar story happened to Roshan's mom, Venetia.
Yes.
I don't know if she ever told you it.
Yes.
But when she was at school and she was doing her lessons and I went to one of the parents' evenings,
yes.
They told her categorically in front of me, she's not going to get history.
Yes.
She's going to fail it.
Yes.
My daughter came out with an A.
Yes.
Right? And she didn't even put a lot of effort in.
Yes.
But it kind of shows you how they can...
yes, manipulate you.
Make
yes.
you feel that yes. you're not worthy.
This conversation is so interesting, how we've all had the same experience.
Yes.
But it's also sad.
It's still happening.
It's sad, though, because I felt like this year I've seen a lot of change with the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah,
but now...
it's a long way to go.
Not, like, it's not you guys' fault, but now I'm talking to you, I'm like, what change is there really? Because when I was in year six, you have to do exams before you leave for school, And... so just when my mum first moved to the area she lives in now, if you remember, it was extremely white.
Yes.
And I was one of the only black people in my whole year.
Yeah.
And I went through a lot of horrible experiences.
Yes,
that at the time, I can't like directly say it was racism, but I was definitely singled out a lot. Even in terms of like being on the committee to sort out the final, like, yes explain, having a part, and before being told you're not in the play anymore.
Yes.
Like, things like that, yeah?
Yes.
And I remember they told me that I was below, they put on my report, because I used to, you know, I've always been into academics.
Yes.
So I used to always read my school report before my mum.
Yes.
And it said I was below average in maths.
Yes.
And I was thinking, how can I be below average in maths? Like, below, not even average, below average. And I knew I was never failing in any of my subjects.
Yes.
So I was really confused. And I took it, and everything else was really high. So I thought, okay, I'll just leave it at that. But the teacher definitely downmarked me, because that was the end of year six, yeah?
Yeah.
And then I had to take entrance exams to get into my secondary school.
Yeah.
And in my secondary school, I was in top sets for everything.
Yes.
And they based that off of your entrance exam.
Yeah.
So how come my entrance exam put me in top set, number one? Not even three or four, number one.
Yes.
But my SATs or whatever it was I took at that time, my teacher thought I was below average. Like, it's just a bit crazy, because if you don't have the right backing and the right community and family behind you, you can see how people will fall through the system.
Will just believe it, exactly. Yes. Yes. And that's probably why a lot of our black people through the ages have failed, because they've taken as gospel what's been told to them by their white counterparts. You can't do this. You're going to fail at this. You're no good.
Mm.
And you start thinking that way. Yes, that's self-fulfilling prophecy. Yes. And if you think about it, what we've just talked about here is like a self-fulfilling prophecy, in terms of it's happened to mum's child, it's happened to my child, and it's happened to you.
Mm. Yes.
And it's actually quite scary that you think that, you know, through the ages, that people would learn from each other and how to make things better.
Yeah.
But you don't. It's just they've found different ways to actually cover up their racism.
Yeah.
And then they use these...
Watch the passion. Yes,
And then they use these words to make you feel like they care.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when what... I think it was in the 80s it came around with the word, the political correct. Yeah,
yes.
Right. Just to make you happy. That's why you said that, yeah?
Mm.
So with things like you can't say this and you can't say that.
Yes.
And now we've got the woke movement. Movement.
Oh, that stop
really
it.
Irritates
that
me.
Irritates me as well.
Really irritates me. Can you shut up, please?
Well, even now, in this century that we are living in, even the black kids is very intelligent and bright. They have to fight for what they get, because if you are working in an organization and you have the same quality, you have the same quality experience or your education, the same education like the white. Instead of that, they have a vacancy going. They're rather to promote the white more than to promote you.
All the time.
You understand?
All
me?
The time.
Yes. So you see what happened. This is an ongoing thing. And racism still exists, but they have it undercover. Like, and if you're not alert, your beliefs said, well, they are for you or whatever it is. But your eyes have to be open to it.
This is the Dope Black Women Podcast.
What are some of the biggest challenges, or what is the biggest challenges you think you had to overcome growing up black in the UK?
First, you have to identify who you is and what you want, and to identify that you are just human, just like anyone else. The only difference it is, and that's what every black person should get, or a black kid should get into their mind, that the only difference with us is the pigment of our skin.
Yeah.
Mm. But we are all the same.
Absolutely.
You understand? We are all the same. It's different. The pigment of our skin makes us different.
Mm.
But we are all the same human being. And, you know, you have to determine in your mind to say that I can achieve anything just like anybody else.
Mm.
You understand what I mean? And if you have that focus in your mind, you understand me, you will reach where you want to reach. Never you let... I mean, because of the person, color of their skin, they're going to put you down. And what I get to find, the white person who travels a lot and mix with people, they are different from those who never have traveled.
That's very true. And that's to do with them.
Because they travel.
Becoming aware they're
able to eat people food and different food. They know the culture. They know everything. So the person who travels a lot and mix with different nationality, you find they are more acceptable.
Mm.
Because in Jamaica, you have a lot of white people living there. And they, when they have people working with them, they would call them the maid, as you would call them, say, a helper here or a cleaner. They call them maid there. With their cheek, the maid have to call their children miss.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. And in Jamaica, you still have white people was living in a country that racist, because when Jamaica was governed by the British, you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
You have a place that they call King Street. You understand me? When you're going down King Street, you have to dress up.
Just that in Kingston?
Just like you're going in Harrods.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
When you go down King Street, a lot of those tours owned by the whites and English and things like
that. Well, in Jamaica?
Yes. And the point about it is when you go down there, if you're not a brown skin, you understand
that's the other
me?
Thing.
From your skin lighter, you can't get a job down there.
Really? The lighter your skin was, is the more privileged
yes,
you were.
And your hair has to be long, and
did you, know
you
that?
Look, and you find that girls used to bleach themselves to you know. The girls, they used to bleach themselves to get color. You understand me?
Yeah.
To get jobs down there. And you find that Jamaicans, when they work with the British, they have to call their children miss.
So you touched on colorism there.
Yes.
Which is something that's still very rife today.
It's very rife today.
So you're obviously a bit darker than me.
Yes.
What was your experience with colorism like
growing
up?
I don't have no problem because I didn't have to go and work for them.
No, but in general, like, did you experience that when you was in the UK amongst other black people?
No. Yes, sometimes you find that even our own black people, them lighter and have a little color.
Mm.
You understand what I mean? And they feel like
they're superior.
Yes, than you.
Because
yeah.
we like now growing up, that's a very big issue
yes.
amongst young black people.
Yes. Some of them going for the color, and the point about it is this: what most of the girls them used to do, they used to bleach themselves.
But you can see it, you know. When I go shopping or I'm out and about, you can see who's bleached because their knuckles don't change.
Yes,
they're really, really dark.
Yes,
or their
yes.
kneecaps are really, really dark.
Yes.
Or they're like the
yes,
point of their elbows.
Yes.
It's sad.
Yeah, they bleach yourself. When Jamaica was populated with a lot of English people.
Mm.
Lot of English. And King Street, that's the shops down there, low. When you're going down Queen Street, you have to put yourself together nice.
So do you remember it quite vividly, being in Jamaica and then lots of white people coming over?
Nab said, I realised that a lot of them was living there, because you can see that they had business there.
Mm.
Because, you know, because we were under the British colony, don't it?
Yeah.
You understand me? So a lot of white people was living there.
Mm.
Yes, mm-hmm. And I believe that, I mean, you said, when they becomes independent, some of them come back. And you have some of them still live there, still.
So we spoke about obstacles for a bit.
Yes.
And I think we can all relate to the type of obstacles we've experienced growing
yes,
up
yeah.
black in the UK.
Yeah.
But Nan, for you, where you've had the experience of that teacher telling you should have worked in Woolworths, for a lot of people that could have like really became their reality.
Yeah.
But what was it for you that kept you determined to drive and get to the success you did in your career? I know your story from how you like started in the college, where you started from to where you ended up.
Yeah.
So for people listening, maybe give a touch on that, from where you started to where you ended up, and then talk about what the determination was. Yeah. What drove you to do that?
So when I left school, primary school, and went on to secondary school, I didn't do very well in secondary school as well as I could have because of two reasons. Mum moved me out of a school which I really loved and put me in a school which was okay, but it was not as good as the school I went to, without going too much into why. And she took me out for a reason, because there was an incident that happened, not to do with me, but an incident. And so I didn't enjoy secondary school, but I also didn't enjoy the fact that I didn't feel I was being taught. Yeah.
Mm.
So I didn't come out with a lot of qualifications at secondary level. And then I had a period in my life where I was, without going into it too much, because that's for another podcast as far as I'm concerned, where I had a rebellious period in my life and got in trouble with the law and stuff. But what was the driving force that allowed me to realise my potential as mum? Because I think the very first thing that happened was, I would say, that she never gave up on me despite my rebellious life. And what she did was, I remember this very clearly, Mum. I don't know if you remember, one of the first things you did was you actually got me a job to be a nurse. Do you remember
mm-hmm.
that, Mum?
Mm-hmm.
In a hospital not too far from here. And I was supposed to start on a Monday, and I didn't go because I thought, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life looking at blood. No way, that's not what I want to do. And then I met your granddad, and things started to change. I became more settled, and I then started to realise where my skills and potential was, because being pregnant with your mum, I then realised that my strengths were in design, because I bought a knitting machine because I was bored, and it just went on from there. But so I went to college and I did, I did some A-levels, and the A-levels then got me in to do BTEC. And when I did the BTEC, I then applied to this art college, which at the time, this was in the 80s, black people don't go there.
Mm.
And they were saying, yeah, getting in there.
Mm.
Let me tell you something.
You got in there.
I actually, you have to bring a portfolio for this art college interviews, right? One portfolio. Your nan bought two big portfolios, yeah? They never said no. They took me and they told me on day. In fact, I think I was about 25 at the time, so they saw me as a mature student. I remember them asking me, how are you going to feel being around young children? And I remember saying to them something very stupid, like, oh, I just feel like I'm being a mother figure, which was true in a way, because I did end up being that. But anyway, to cut a long story short, I did achieve, and I went to one of the top art colleges that's really hard to get into. And then, as soon as I graduated, I managed to get, like, four teaching jobs, and I didn't plan to do teaching. Mm. I planned to be a designer. But I fell into it, and I think the reason why I fell into it is because when I was doing my degree, I realised I loved sharing my skills and people enjoyed coming to me and learning from me, and I realised I really enjoyed it. So I took up these teaching jobs, and then I started a knitwear business as well. So alongside the knitwear business, I did the teaching to supplement the knitwear business. Then I had my second child, Nathan, and realised that I couldn't cope with the business and the teaching, so I gave up the business and took up more teaching once Nathan got a bit older. And I never aspired that I would climb the ladder I did. I didn't kind of say, like, 30 years ago, I want to be a head of department. But I think through determination, hard work, commitment, and a passion as well, and also most importantly, loving to working with children, not children, but students who had low aspirations, and making them realise that they could achieve, you know, just like anyone else, if they just know what their passions are. That was, I found that was my calling. And so for 30 years of my adult life, I was in education, and my drive was to help students, in particular black students. I did help white students as well, don't get me wrong, because I treated them all the same. But I made sure that those students that other teachers wrote off, I showed them that you can do it. And I can proudly say that I got a lot of students onto degrees who other students said, teachers said they wouldn't be able to get onto degrees.
Do you think, you spoke about a minute ago, or you touched on part of the passion being helping people to basically see their full potential.
Yeah.
Do you think that passion came from you realising that you didn't get that experience?
Absolutely. I think I wanted to ensure that history didn't repeat itself from my point of view, and that I was helping to help students who people are writing off and saying they're no good, they're never going to get anywhere in life, and letting them realise you are good and you are going to get somewhere. You've just got to believe, you've just got to be aspirational. And I think one of the key things I always used to do with my students, and it worked, was, what do you love doing the most?
Mm.
What gives you a passion? What
you do you enjoy doing?
And you find that when you find that they get that answer, then they run in terms of their you know, skill set, their ability, and where they want to go.
I remember being in year 11.
Yeah.
And you asking me, oh, what are you going to do when you go to college? And me being like, oh, I don't know, I liked every subject. And you was like, okay, but if you had to do one subject all the time, what would it be?
Yeah.
And that
is actually the most. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was literally how I was able to, like, spin on my career.
I do it all the time. I used to do it all the time with my students, and I found that it was foolproof in helping them to realise their potential. Because sometimes what I think happens is that a lot of students, in particular black students, are told that they're not good at something, or they're told you need to do this, or even by their parents as well, they're forced to do something they don't really love, so they don't give it the 100%. And I can honestly say that I had a lot of students, in particular Asian students, that used to come into me after being told they, by their parents, they had to be doctors, who then dropped off out after a year to come and do what they really loved. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah. So
it's something that happens all the time, whereby a lot of students, well, not even students, but a lot of people are told that they can't do something, but they're never given that support to let them realise what their potential is.
Mm.
So I think that's what my calling was.
They're kind of talking about how he was giving other people opportunities.
Mm.
And I think that a positive to growing up black in the UK
mm.
is that if you search properly, there are like lots of opportunities for, I hate definitely. This word, but like BAME people. I'm not BAME, I'm black.
Yeah.
And I think for me, I know I definitely benefited from schemes to do with that or yeah. scholarships to do with that and things like that. So, Gran, when you came over here, mm. what were like, bit like really, what are some of the big opportunities you were able to take hold of, and what was the impact?
For me, that's a difficult question because I don't remember any opportunities in my era that I could come across that said, you're going to be able to do this scholarship or you're going to be able to do this course free. They probably had things like, I don't know, brownies, but you know, like Duke of Edinburgh Award stuff and whatever, mm-hmm. but there wasn't anything major in my era that I can think of. Somebody might be able to enlighten me on that, whereby you were told there's this, you know, like the BBC have a scheme for black people who they want to raise their profile in the industry. There wasn't things like that back in my day.
Mm.
There's nothing I can think of off the top of. All I can remember in my era was I had to work twice as hard as my counterpart to get to where I wanted. So the story about two portfolios when everybody's bringing one is a classic example of what I'm talking about. And even when I was in art school, I had to make sure that I worked twice as hard and did much more work than everyone else mm-hmm. to even be recognised in terms of my creativity, even though I was good.
But how do you think that's a subconscious thing? Because, like, I remember going to uni, and doing similar things. So, like, they would say, you don't need a portfolio. And I still brought a portfolio. Or they would say to me, you only need to have one piece of example of your writing. And I would bring a book of examples of my writing. I did, like, layouts. I did everything I knew the topics would cover for 3 years.
Yeah.
I had an example of in this book that I brought. So I feel like, when looking back, I can't tell you what made me feel like I had to work harder than everybody else. I didn't feel like I was ever told from my mum, you're going to have to work harder than your white counterpart. But I feel like within me, I always had that.
I think for me, subconsciously, I felt I had to because of what experiences I encountered.
Mm.
So I knew that if I just gave one picture in a portfolio, I'd not stand a chance. Whereas my white counterpart just needed a brilliant drawing and they'd get in. Mm. And that's what I'm talking about.
You have to work harder.
Subconsciously, I knew that if I didn't go 110%, it was more than likely I wasn't going to get to that goal I wanted as a black person.
Yeah.
I'm talking about in my era.
Yeah.
This is the Dope Black Women podcast.
If there was anything you would change about your early years in the UK, what would it be?
The opportunity that I would like to take over, as I said, that I love dressmaking. I want to do designing. And the other thing that I love is teaching.
Mm.
Yeah. I would like to do that if I had the opportunity to do so. I love talking to people.
Mm.
And that was good.
Yeah.
Nursing is the other thing again as well. I like hearing. But the thing about it is just the blood.
So then you put me into it, man. How dare you?
I did a part of it, you know.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Oh gosh, I forget what that's called.
Like a healthcare assistant.
Not healthcare. I work into when Springfield office hospital was down here. I work in the I forget what you call that department. Not with the mad people.
We don't use that word.
It's not mad.
Mental health. Yes. I work with them, you know, and my other job that I love as well, that was, I did nursing eggs, a clinic auxiliary.
It was more or less a receptionist, Mum. You worked in a clinic where you basically,
I had to book in the mothers, the babies and all of those things.
Mm.
And it was a very good job. I like it because they were about to send me to college to do typing day release.
Mm.
And that was the time I gave up my job for Venetia and Layla.
Mm.
because
we were doing our degrees.
When they were going to do their degree, they wanted was to board them out, you know, to be cared for. And I said, no, it's not going to happen. So I start taking them to school, and they were with me. Yes, they were living with me. I take them, and they were living with me in Tooting. And I have to take them to school in the mornings, and then I have to reach at my job for 9 o'clock because I have to set up the doctor's room. And
oh, you looked after them and worked?
Yes.
Did you?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
I was working at Plough Road Health Clinic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have to set up the doctor's room and get out all the immunization and everything, and it has to be dead at 9.
So for people listening, Venetia and Layla, Venetia's my mum.
Yes.
But Venetia and Layla are your grandchildren.
Yes, beautiful grandchildren. And so I have Sister Donna. I used to carry them there to Sister Donna, and she dropped them off at school for me that I can get to work for 9. So when I was in Tooting, I said, well, I'm going to transfer to Amen Corner.
Mm.
That is our health clinic. But the work there was heavy because you have to do 2 sessions, a clinic, on a Tuesday. Because there were so many people, you understand, at that one clinic. And I find it was too much for me. And one day I spoke to the nursing officer. And she said, oh, Eula, you're going to give up your job for grandchildren. When these children come, they're not going to do so and so, and you have a future and whatever it is. And I really love the job because even the doctors, they commend me all the time to my boss, you know, that you have a very good receptionist there. She's at the phone and now she speaks to people and things like that.
Looking back, do you regret doing that?
No, I don't regret. You know, I regret in a sense that the only regret you regret, you would get 2 pensions.
Yeah.
But I don't regret in a sense because what I able to impart to my 2 grandchildren, you understand, it will remain with them for life.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not regret 1 minute of it because I didn't have an ex person into their life. I was a part of their life in the early stage of their life. You know, and until this day, they don't forget it, and I don't forget it.
Mm. I think also I should intercept her and say, Mum, that your sacrifice that you made at that time was absolutely amazing because you allowed 2 of your daughters to achieve their ambitions in relation to finishing their degrees.
Yes,
I mean, I remember when I was doing my degree, I did not have to worry about babysitting
or having
to get on to a child. This is my work ethic was I used to work right through till sometimes 11 o'clock the college was closing and they had to come and get me out of the room because that's how hard I used to work. And that kind of went through into my work. But I think more than anything, I'm always been grateful to the fact that you sacrificed that time of your life to allow myself and my sister, who is now in America, to achieve our goals. But I think it kind of swings in roundabouts, Mum, because in a way, one thing you can say about which maybe a lot of mothers don't have, well, for you anyway, is that you have, your family are very closely tied to you.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
we always look up to you and we do look after you as well, don't we?
I think
you don't want for anything. And I think it's an example of how grateful we are in terms of the sacrifices you made.
I never regretted one moment.
Do you
understand what I mean? Because I mean, you know, I was there for them, and nobody, when it come to Pauline and Patsy, they didn't have to worry at no time at all. Because those children stay with me all the time.
Yeah, they
stay.
Do you
think that communities are as strong and as close knit now as they were before?
No. Because you find that parents today, they want to be like their children because parents have their children young and they want to be like their children. They don't make that sacrifice no more. You don't find that no more.
That's true.
Not even grandparents is doing that no more.
Mm.
You understand what I mean? Because they just want to get on with their life. They just don't want to do it. But I am glad because from 0 to 5 is very important in a child's life.
Mm.
And I'm glad to know that nobody outside of the family, you understand what I mean, as ever take the part of my two grandchildren, my two first grandchildren in life. Yeah. I was there for them.
What do you think are some of the big changes as to why the communities aren't as close-knit as before?
Well, the thing about it is, being a mother, it means sacrifice.
Mm.
And if a person is going to have a child and you don't decide to make sacrifice, don't have a child. Because number one, you cannot have the things them that you used to have when you're single. Number one, you cannot live the way you used to live, because all of those things is for your child. And a mother means sacrifice.
Mm.
And this generation don't make up their mind to do that.
Mm.
You understand what I mean? They'll have their child and they want to live same way and have everything same way.
What do you mean by that, Mom?
Well, I simply means by that, for instance, when you're a single parent, you can go out there and buy a pair of shoes for £80.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a child, you can't afford to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to think that what you used to spend on yourself,
you have to spend
some of that have to go and spend on the child. And if you don't spend on the child, you have to put some down for that child. But later on in that child's life, as a child to get older, whether you want your child to go private school or nursery or whatever it is, you just have to be different. So it is best if you think of having a child and you enjoy your life first. You understand me? Because mm-hmm. when you have that child, you understand what I mean? You have to make sacrifices for that child. You have to think of it differently, because the moment a child reaches an age and maybe you want to go back to work, you have to think of nursery, you have to think of this, you have to think of that. Mm. You understand me?
Yeah.
So that's why I said being a mother, it means sacrifice. Mm. And this generation don't make up their mind to do that. Because, for instance, if you have a child as a young person, you love to go to parties. When you have the baby, you want to go to parties, same way you want to do everything, same way. And that child is missing out.
Mm.
And so that's why you find that this generation is different completely.
Yeah.
The closeness that my children have with me, you understand what I mean? You find this generation don't have that closeness with their parents.
Mm.
Because I was there for them. I work from home. I wouldn't allow nobody to look after her. Pauline was the first one here that born. And I did not go out to work until Pauline was 1 year. And I was very fussy where hygiene concerned with my children. So I have this mind that looking after Pauline. And we call it a base in Jamaica. They call it a bowl here.
Mm.
So I get a little bowl. I get our flannel. I get everything that when I take her to our child minder, if she need a little water to tidy her down or whatever it is, she have my own bowl and my whole basin and things like that. And I used to work in all my jobs that I do, it's the West End.
Mm. What would you say was some of the best parts about motherhood?
The best part of motherhood is there to care for your child yourself. You understand what I mean? To see that child take the first step.
Mm.
You know? Mm. And because from 0 to 5 is very important in a child's life. And so I was at work one day. So we do piecework, you know? Mm-hmm. When I mean piecework, they give you a bundle, a dress, a 4 or 5, and you have to finish those 5 for the day.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And so while I was there working, and it's just like somebody come and talk to me, go home straight away, go to get Pauline.
Mm-hmm.
And believe you me, I could not resist that spirit was speaking to me. And I went to Mr. Davis. He was our boss. And I said, Mr. Davis, could you allow me to go home now, please?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but you don't finish. I said, I'll take some of the work home with me and do it at home and bring it. Because you're allowed to take home work, sew it at home and bring it back.
Yeah.
So I said, I'll take home some and bring it. And as I get off the train, and I rushed to Mail Road, right, I was been at Pellet Road, and rushed to Mail Road, right where the lady looking after Pauline. And she said, Miss Carr, what are you doing here so early? I said, no, I'm let off early today. When I go, the bowl that I gave her, she have it on the floor with water. And those days, they never have social worker who check on them.
Yeah.
They can have 7-8 children.
Yeah.
And she have all the children around her. And the flannel that I gave her to wash my child. She have the flannel, the same flannel in
washing
here,
everybody.
Wiping all the children.
Oh my gosh. So something in your spirit told you, you need to go there and get your child and take them
home.
Yes, ma'am.
And I take the bowl. And I take everything and I say, sorry, I'm taking her home. Until Monday morning, I told her, I'm not taking her back there.
Mm-mm.
You understand me?
Mm-hmm.
And then I take her to all the childminder and I still never satisfy. And from then on, I said, no way, I am going to work from home to look after my children.
Mm. Granny, did you ever talk to your kids about racism?
Yes, we talk about it. They know it. They know about it. We talk about it.
But at what point did you think it was important to do that? Because I don't remember having any conversations with my mum about that.
It's important, all aspect of their life, because sometimes when they tell me of situation that happened at school or university or whatever it is, and I says that don't matter how you see these children, sometimes the children, the black, the white children, research them, oh, you don't have to do this and do that. I said, don't take no note of them. You understand? Because sometimes they finish the work already, I'm telling you that.
Yeah.
I said, always aim to work harder than them. You understand what I mean? Because at the end of the day, they can always mess about and they get a good job. And you have your qualification and they get a better job than you.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you have to work twice time harder than the white.
In your experience, and this is to both of you, what do you think is some of the biggest change you've seen in terms of the black experience in the UK?
Well, the biggest change that I've seen that our children today can able to achieve more than in the 50s, 60s, and the 80s coming up. They definitely can achieve more because, I mean, they said the English is aware that we realize that racism exists.
Mm.
You understand? It's more open up now.
Yeah.
More than back there. You understand? They were trying to cover it up, but it's more open up now.
Yeah.
And our black children today, this generation, is aware of it and they cannot mess about because once they see it, they are going to expose it.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So they have a better chance, even more than children in the 50s and the 60s and the 80s.
I think I would just add to that, Mum. What
yes.
Mum said is absolutely spot
yes,
on.
Yes.
That there are much more opportunities
they
now
can't, yes, they can't
than there was when I was growing up.
Yes,
yeah.
And it is getting better and better. Don't get me wrong. We've been
yes.
talking about, oh, we've
yes.
been disadvantaged, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
It is getting better and better. Yes. But my problem is, it's not quick enough
yes.
in that
yes.
you've. This has been going on since year dot
yes.
from when my mum came over.
Yes.
And yet we're just taking little tiny steps.
Yes.
And even though I think the Black Lives Matter movement has really helped to spiral it a bit more forward,
mm.
sometimes I feel there's parts of that's tokenistic.
Mm.
Like,
yes.
oh, let's do this. Oh, I've read this book. I
yes.
think we should do this. You know, please,
yeah.
be real. Don't just do it because you want to show that you care.
Yeah.
Genuinely care. Prove
yeah.
it to me. Do you understand
authentic.
What I'm saying?
Yeah.
yeah, be authentic. And I sometimes feel that some of it is not authentic. It's just there to make it look like, let's keep them quiet and do what it is they want.
No, I agree with you. I think there's a blogger. Do you know what that is, Granny?
What? No.
Do you know what a blogger is?
Uh-uh.
It's basically someone who has a platform
yes.
that shares lots of content on it.
Oh, yes.
So I could have an Instagram account
yes.
and I share lots of stuff about fashion.
Oh yes,
lots
yes,
of pictures.
Yeah.
I'm a fashion blogger.
Oh.
But like there was a blogger called Jackie Aina. She's really famous.
Yes.
And she basically did a campaign during the Black Lives Matter movement where
yeah.
she called out lots of brands
yeah.
that were putting up the black square.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which was meant to be like represent, like saying they represent black people, black culture, and they're standing
yeah.
with things
yeah.
that have been going on. They're standing in solidarity with black people.
Mm.
And she was calling them out and saying, how can you stand with us today, but you've never ever used black people in your campaign?
Yes,
yeah.
You've
yes.
never ever posted black people
that's
online.
Yes.
You've been called out for this racist thing or
yes.
you've got a reputation for having, you know, racism, racism being communicated to your staff, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera,
yes.
et cetera. So I really agree with that. But what, Fernand, what do you think can be done next? Like, how do you think we can move on from the current situation we're in
Me,
now?
Me, I personally feel the first port of call is education.
Mm. Mm.
Unless you educate the ignoramuses amongst us to understand that we're all equal, and more importantly, that we have a history too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just your history, it's our history too. Mm-hmm. And that it's actually put out there within the educational curriculum,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to move forward. Because at the moment, we've got history that's told by them. Yeah. We haven't got any history that talks about us and how we've got here. And so for that reason, we won't move forward unless the English or our Caucasians admit that, you know, colonization has made them superior to us.
Yeah.
And that we need to kind of look at how we can change that. Mm-hmm. And they have to be honest with themselves first.
Yeah.
To tell the story. Mm-hmm. They can't just do what they're doing at the moment, offering a few million or 1,000 here and 2,000 here. Here we go, we can help you with this. Oh, no, no, it's not just that. It's not just that. Putting a statue in a museum and telling me this is what he did in slavery, but still acknowledging him as a hero, don't help me.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah. What do you think, Granny?
Well, I think the same. You understand? The thing about it is now, in this century that we are into, white people is exposed so much for what they have done to the blacks and other nationalities that they cannot cover it up no more.
Mm.
You understand what I mean? They cannot cover it up no more. It is wide open. You think of Oxford University, that as a black person, don't matter how you have a qualification, you cannot get there so easily.
Mm.
You understand what I mean? Yeah. And they were being exposed. You understand what I mean? The black has rights there just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I mean? So they cannot cover it up no more. It is open up now. You understand what I mean? Because most of what this country here possess, you know, is what they go to other countries like Africa, the West Indies, and all those things. They take from there to build themselves up here. You understand what I mean? And all these things are exposed.
Yeah.
You understand me? So what we suffer in the 70s and all these things when we come here as black people, this generation is not going to happen to them because they are not going to accept it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nan, this is my final question to you now. What do you hope that I can go on to do and achieve that you didn't get to do?
I think it's important that if you're good at something, that you can be represented at the top.
Mm.
At the moment, I don't think that happens. So I would like to know that you and people like you who are good at what you do and excel are given the opportunity to be able to excel genuinely rather than just tokenistically. Do you understand what I'm getting at?
100%.
So that's my probably aspiration, is that we're seen as human beings in the first instance, as opposed to the colour for our work, rather than the colour of our skin.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the barrier is at the moment, I feel, is that they look at our skin first before they look at our ability and our knowledge and our skill set. That happens a lot.
No, 100%.
Just the colour, and you see the thing about it is, if you look on the sole of your feet, it never black enough.
Mm.
It don't black, it white.
Yeah.
It makes sure that we're all equal.
Mm.
We're all equal people. It's just a pigment. Make the difference.
Yeah. And for you, Granny, what legacy do you want to leave for me and the family?
Well, I want the legacy to leave to me and my my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren and the whole family that stand up for what is right. Because we are all equal in the sight of God. And whatever the white can achieve, you can achieve it too. Or never feel yourself that you cannot achieve. You can achieve anything that the white man out there, you understand, can achieve. And you must always aim high. You understand? Because it is out there for all of us. We are all equal in the sight of God.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That was really cute.
Yes.
That's all for today, guys. Thank you so much for listening. You can find us on Instagram at DopeBlackWoman1. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Dope Black Woman. So that's all for today. Until then, stay all the way black.
Blackity black.
Blacktastic.
Yay! You're talking about the cars.
Yes.
Did you just fart?
Why not?
Oh my gosh.
She does it all the time. Listen.
No.
Dan.
You got out of order.
I must be eating something.
You couldn't even say excuse me.
You don't hear nothing.
Is I heard it.
No.
Yeah, I did. All I heard was.
Sorry, I don't know if mum should take the phone off the hook.